Life without hope. Now that's living hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope. It means hope.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. We are so glad that you guys are continuing on this journey through Haddonfield and all of the Halloween films. If you guys have not checked out our previous six episodes yet, it's between crossovers, exclusive content on YouTube, and podcast episodes. Go back and check those out. We'll have links in the descriptions below. Please help me in welcoming from the Fear of God podcast, Mr. Reed Lackey.
Hello, Josh. How are you?
It's good, man. It's good. So I didn't actually realize this until this is like super low key. So like normal, most podcasts like celebrate. I did not honestly know this until 2 minutes ago. This is actually our 150th episode.
So, what?
Yeah.
What? Oh my gosh. Milestone happening in real time. Congratulations on 150 episodes, brother. That is phenomenal. That is incredible. Incredible work. That's a lot to get there. We only just crossed our 100th, and we get it. We understand how much work goes into it. So congratulations. Hats off literally to you. That is fantastic.
Hey, thanks, bro. So congratulations on celebrating 100 episodes with you guys as well.
Thank you.
Which is weird because like I knew for like our 100th episode, I wanted to do something like really big and extraordinary, and 150 came around, and I was like, I think it's going to be like right in the middle of like Halloween. So let's just start planning 102, like the 200th episode. So like
that's sure
where I'm looking towards right now. But yeah, congratulations on 150 with you guys as well.
No, thank you. Thank you. We appreciate that. Yeah, we're having a good time. We're having a good time.
So if the listeners at home don't actually know, tell us a little bit about what the Fear of God actually is.
Certainly. So our show basically explores, as we put it, the intersection between the horror genre and Christianity. So we look at films in and of themselves, what we like about them, what scares us, what we don't like about them, etc. And then we take the latter part of the episode to explore what the themes in that particular film or piece. We've explored pieces of literature and music. We've branched out a bit, but we explore what those pieces of material say to us about life and faith and all that goes with that. We call ourselves we have two sort of slogans, as it were. The first is we say we are explorers, not explainers. So we don't have easy, quick bumper sticker answers for everything, but we like to chart out the territory and sort of explore that territory together in community. And then the second one is that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. So that's what we're all about.
So I feel like, and from being a Christian man myself, and you know, this isn't a outward like Christian podcast. We've had those conversations before. Anytime that they come up, especially with having, you know, friends like Geek Devotions and Consuming Fire Gaming. But I think my biggest question is like, just from personal experience, I know that like at least in my circle, like Christianity and horror, they're kind of like, it's kind of like an oxymoron. So where did you guys kind of come up with the idea to marry these two things together?
Sure, sure. Well, in brief, I've always been – I grew up in church culture. So as I jokingly say, I cut my teeth on church pews. And for me, almost every conversation was a theological conversation. You almost couldn't avoid it. I grew up in the South, charismatic Pentecostal church culture. So everything sort of revolved around analyzing things in light of theological considerations. Well, then I became this rabid movie buff, and particularly the horror genre really stood out to me as a favorite of mine. I saw Psycho when I was six. My favorite film of all time is The Exorcist. Not just favorite horror film, but my favorite film is The Exorcist. So a lot in the horror genre really resonate with me and communicate with me in certain ways. And so then, obviously, as I'd said, so much of my framework revolved around theological conversations. I found myself in personal conversations constantly bringing things up from horror films, but in relation to sort of spiritual matters, and not always just chapter and verse, or this thing connects to the nature of sin, or you know, some of those broad topics, but sometimes very specific things about either the psychology or the practical navigation of the world with spiritual considerations. Well, then I was at first a recurring guest, and then eventually one of the co-hosts for a podcast called More Than One Lesson with Tyler Smith. And that podcast just covers movies in general, not any specific genre of film, just films in general in light of Christian perspectives. And then I had spoken to Tyler about, hey, I really think we could maybe do a version of these kinds of conversations, but focusing exclusively on the horror genre. And he became very excited about it. He asked if we would come under the umbrella of More Than One Lesson, which we are. I reached out to my co-host, Nathan Rouse, who's been my friend for nearly 20 years, and the rest is history. We put some things together, some preliminary sort of formatting questions together, and then we launched a little over 2 years ago, and been going about 104, 105 episodes so far.
So do you ever find that with, you know, your circle of people, when it comes to the do you guys experience those taboos with, you know, time talking about Christianity and like horror? Because I know that, like, obviously we're talking right now via video chat on Google, but sure, people aren't going to see this. Like, the nun is I'm wearing a nun hat right now.
Right.
And, like, but I also, like, those are conversations that, like, I never would tell people in my church or, like, in my circle of, you know, Christian friends that, oh, yeah, sure, I really have enjoyed going through the Conjuring series. But, like, it's one of those things that, like, if the conversation comes up, I'm not going to, you know, hide and be weird about it. Like, I'm going to confront it head on. But it's kind of one of those things, too. It's like, do you guys, especially with, you know, being a Christian and, having your favorite movie be The Exorcist, do you find these kind of taboo conversations with people around you?
Yeah, the short answer is they do still occur, but I think from my personal experience, they are happening less frequently. In the early days, they happened a lot, and we actually just not that long ago had somebody that we didn't know personally approach the Facebook group and basically said, you know, it's very disappointing that a Christian organization is promoting horror films. And so we do occasionally have people who will experience or express the taboo. In my personal experience, in the early days of when I would have those conversations, I would tell people my favorite movie was The Exorcist, and I would see the faces go pale. I would see the, you know, the gasps around the room. But as particularly my friends, as we've had these kind of conversations, now I find that more people simply find it interesting. More people simply think, wow, that's a different take. Tell me more about that. So they find it interesting versus finding it automatically taboo. Again, you do still have the people who are, as you've expressed, so ingrained in horror movies are bad, these kind of things are bad for you, so stay far, far away from them. But our experience, particularly in the life and the run of the show, is that we've developed this broader community of people who often they have approached us and said, wow, it's so great to find brothers and sisters, friends who just feel the same way we do because we've felt so homeless loving horror films, but still really being devoted to our walk with faith and not really knowing how to intersect those things. And so more often than not, I think more people are finding it interesting. And I think more and more specifically religious organizations are beginning to see the value in the right contexts and with the right mindsets of exploring some of these territories in light of what the scripture has to say. We actually have a couple of pastor listeners who have reached out to us and have become dear friends. And yeah, it's been very encouraging. The taboo's still there, but it's lessening.
No, I understand. And like, I used to run a men's like discipleship group, but like all of our teachings came through the mediums of like comic books. So we would take like a panel or something at a comic book mediums. And like, we would apply it to like something out of the Bible, and you know, you would go in depth with that. So like, I understand, like, and but when you would tell people about that, they'd be like, what?
right.
And so like, even now, like, my wife and I, we do like I said before, like, this isn't a Christian podcast by any means, but we do the ministry side of Victims and Villains, where we've gone in, we've had the capability of going into churches and teaching them about the statistics of suicide and like the education and the reality of it, and offering hope for those that are struggling, but also going into comic book conventions and putting resources into people and just having these conversations that really kind of need to be had. And it's funny that you like, you can look at like these different kind of mediums that I think a lot of people kind of like look down upon, but yet still draw some inspiration from the Word of God.
Absolutely. And if I may say so, not just because I'm on your show at the moment, but seriously, man, God bless your work, because there are so many people, religious or otherwise, who there's such a stigma around that conversation of people who are just dwelling in hopelessness. And the fact that you and everyone associated with Victims and Villains are trying so hard to put the word out there, like you said, about statistics, providing avenues for hope, having the conversation is so important. And so sincerely, from my heart, God bless your work, because it's really fantastic.
Well, thank you, Reed.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I mean that.
All right, so be sure to check out the Fear of God podcast. We'll have links in the descriptions below, but we're kind of celebrating 150 on this episode with not talking about one Halloween movie, but two. And so we're going to kind of rotate, but the majority of this episode is going to focus on H2O. But given that this is the podcast that focuses on hope and speaking life and hope to people, we found that we didn't really have a whole lot of hopeful things to say about the eighth installment into the Halloween franchise, and that is Halloween Resurrection.
Everyone can see you. Everyone can hear you.
Wait, what just happened?
But on July 12th, no one can help you. Halloween Resurrection.
Are you scared?
No.
Rated R, in theaters everywhere, Friday, July 12th.
So I'm going to let you go first. Thoughts on,
oh boy,
quick thoughts on Halloween Resurrection.
Well, most of my positive thoughts all revolve around the first 15 minutes of Resurrection. I think that there's a world in which the first 15 minutes of Resurrection, wherein they tie up a bow on what I'm sure we will discuss of the ending of Halloween H2O, that first 15 minutes feels so tightly constructed and so complete in and of itself that it really feels a shame that there's another like 75 minutes to follow that of just this insane just reaching and stretching for any sort of prop. One of the things that I will say is, again, I think the first 15 minutes of Resurrection, if you're a fan of the Halloween franchise and you have never seen Resurrection because it got so panned, by all means, rent it, check out the first 15 minutes, and then just make up whatever happens after that, because it even concludes in such a way that you could walk away from the film and be fine. I rewatched it for this conversation. I've seen H2O enough times I didn't have to refresh. I can speak very avidly to that.
What? I'm so sorry, I know. I had to put you through Resurrection again.
I know, man. So I was like, you know what? Let me just buckle up. Let me just watch this. And sure enough, first 15 minutes, you know, I was like, okay, there's some hit, there's some miss. It's not fantastic, but it's solid, and particularly flowing out of H2O, it's logical. But then, yeah, there's this whole, like, we're going to be webcamming the, you know, an overnight stay in the Myers house, and why in the world Myers is back and how he got back and all of it. It's just such a stretch, and it is prop up after prop up of just trying to be inventive kills, but they're really just utterly cliche. The script is terrible. There is just really not a lot of things that I can prop up about Resurrection that are very positive. And I feel bad saying that about any film, because I'm sure people worked hard to put it out there, but it's really not worth virtually anybody's time, in my humble opinion.
No, I totally agree. And like, when I was watching this, and so when I was watching it for the specific episode, I was like, all right. I had like these like fond memories of it because like, I saw it when I was younger, because I feel like when you're younger, you can appreciate it a little bit more because it's kind of goofy. It's kind of silly. It's just this like, you know, typical whatever. It's like just a typical, but as, when you like watch it as an adult, like you're trying to look at it from a critical point of view, it's like the first 15 minutes of it feel like kind of like this like short film. It's like maybe like this is like an alternative reality of, oh, hey, like this is what happened after the events of the last film that we'll get ready to talk about in just a couple minutes. But to me, like, there's just not a lot that I can say about this, and I feel really bad because it's a really interesting concept, but it kind of comes in the wake of Blair Witch Project was how I looked at it. Blair Witch Project was this massively successful film in 99, and found footage was still riding high in the early 2000s when this came out. So they were like, oh, well, what if we did this with Michael Myers? And it's like, it's a bold new direction, and I will give it that. Like, I will give it that it's bold new resurrection. But I've been, if you guys want to read my full review, go to victimsandvillains.net /reviews. I'm just not going to talk about it on here because it's super negative. I gave it a half a star.
Ooh, yeah.
And this is how I ended it. I said, to say resurrection has anything redeeming about it would be an insult to the very word of redemption. So it's just not a good movie. And
I can't disagree with you, brother. That's pretty appropriate.
It's so bad. Like they took this really interesting concept, and so this is one thing I'm going to say about this, and I'm going to pitch you this, see if, if this maybe would have made it a little bit more interesting for you. So Curse of Michael Myers, which was the sixth installment, told it from Tommy's point of view from the very first film, kind of how he's coped with it and kind of like, you know, trying to move it into a new direction. I love that approach. I felt like what they could have done with Resurrection is they could have taken something similar to where they could have had Sarah, who was the little girl from the other little girl that Laurie watches in the beginning, and kind of had her in the Sarah role. And I felt like maybe that would have been like a little bit more cooler. You could have done a little bit more with it. It could have been taken something from the old franchise, but or from the, you know, older films, but still kind of breathing new life into it and taking it into that new direction.
Yeah, you know, I would have liked for the, you know, the bulk, the 75 minutes that followed that opening, to have had anything else to do with the rest of the franchise. So yeah, I'm all on board for Sarah coming back. I'm all on board for additional connections, because as it stands, these are just random hapless victims who know the lore of Michael Myers, and that is somewhat frustrating because, I mean, the continuity in the Halloween franchise has been all over the map. You really have, you know, you have your first two, which, by the way, Resurrection was directed by the director Rick Rosenthal of Halloween 2. So you would expect a little bit more coming from that. I know, right? Can you believe that?
What?
Same exact director. And you would expect there to be a superior product than what we have. But yeah, it really is unfortunate. You have, you know, the first two installments, Season of the Witch is its own thing. And then 4, 5, and 6, you know, Return, Revenge, and Curse build up their own sort of mythology. It would have been really nice, you know, of course, H2O, which we'll talk about in a second, returns to the core story. And it would have been really nice if Resurrection had followed that opening in the asylum with some additional throwbacks, additional characters, some additional loop in to the greater mythology. But as it stands, as you put it, I'm sure it was trying to ride the found footage wave, the found footage gimmick. And as such, it is just a little more than a series of set pieces that mean very little to the ultimate mythology, and thus leave the reader or leave the viewer feeling very sort of like this didn't mean much to me or to the greater Halloween mythos, as it were. So yeah. I like your pitch, though. I would have liked any connection to the greater mythology of Halloween.
I think it would have been cool because I don't know if you are a comic reader at all, but they actually in the early 2000s, they took these, like, they continued on with the 4, 5, 6 mythology, and they set up this 3-issue arc that was told over the course of, I think, 3 years, where essentially it was like continuing Tommy's adventure, and then he gets like put into like something like Smith's Grove, and Lindsay Wallace comes in, and then their arcs kind of, she has her arc, and then third issue they, Tommy and Lindsay Wallace's arc connect, and then they the ending, the twist at the end about who Michael Myers really is it's mind-blowing. Like, it connects it all back.
Really?
It's so good, dude.
I'm going to have to try to seek those out somewhere, because I'm familiar with those. I am a periodic comic reader, so I have not stumbled across those, but those sound really interesting. I would love to see where they went with that. That's great.
I'll send you some titles, and I'll send you the titles, and I will also send, I will also have a link in the below if you guys also want to check those out, because they're worth a read.
They're awesome.
It's like the arc's just a standard like graphic novel. You can probably knock it out in like an hour and a half. It's
nice. It's really, okay, cool. That's awesome. No, thanks for the recommendation.
But if you guys are listening to this right now and you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 123 suicides that occur each and every day, and for every successful one of those suicides, 25 more being attempted. That's 3,075 suicides that occur each and every day. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That's one death roughly every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can go reach out to us on any of our social media, click the links in the descriptions below. You guys can also go to victimsandvillains.net/hope, where you guys can get even more resources. That also includes the Suicide Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255, or also text anonymously to 741-741. But we're going to be back on the other side of this break talking all things Halloween H2O.
Hi, my name is Matthew Basil, and I am the creator and writer of Wolf's Howl, a limited comic book series about an ancient war between werewolves and energy vampires known as Dark Ones. The story follows the original alpha male and female werewolves as they face an unknown threat that is exterminating their kind and tearing apart the very life forces on Earth. Wolf's Howl is a limited comic book series, and all the artwork and lettering is completed for the first installment, done by the very talented Sergio Drummond. I'll be premiering the first issue in a Kickstarter this October to raise funds for printing and marketing this epic tale about the forces of nature within us all. Please follow along on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can do this by following The Conjuring Pen. Come join the Wolf Pack.
Critics call Halloween H2O sensational. Smart and non-stop scary. Finally, a sequel that lives up to the original. Halloween H2O, rated R. Starts Wednesday everywhere.
All right. It's, I don't know, I was going to say maybe 20 seconds later, but I don't know how long our commercial break is. So it's 20 years later after the original, and which it's 20 years flies by so fast. Feels like just a couple weeks ago we were talking the original with Subliminal Films. Oh wait, that was just a couple weeks ago. I'm gonna let you open this up, man. What are your general thoughts about this?
Okay, so this is at present my favorite of the sequels. So Halloween H2O, the sort of the hierarchy of the overall Halloween pantheon, as it were, the original, the best film, in my opinion, but a second to me, not necessarily a close second, but a strong second, is Halloween H2O. I am fond of the original direct sequel, Halloween 2, and really there are several entries in the franchise that I'm generally very fond of, but I really like how this film felt a bit like the original, felt a bit less sensationalized. I feel like all of the horror franchises, as the sequels progress, they begin to get bigger, bolder. They try to be more elaborate with their kills. They try to be more outrageous with their formatting. I really like that this film itself is rooted in character, specifically in the character of Laurie Strode. And I like where it takes, you know, her potential journey. One of the things I am extremely excited for, and as of this recording, you know, we have yet to see how it will play out, but I'm extremely excited for Horizon because it appears to be doing kind of a similar thing where it's, we're going to root this into a continuation of the original mythology. I liked that H2O did that. I liked that, and I don't know if you know, Jamie Lee Curtis was a major player behind getting this film made. She was the one who wanted to bring the team back together for 20 years later, have a reunion, tag back in on this character, and do some different stuff with it. She wanted Carpenter to come on board. But at the time, as apocryphal knowings would have it, he was still very much frustrated by the lack of financial windfall that he had experienced from the success of the first film. And he had been bothered by some of the directions that the franchise had taken in subsequent entries. He was bothered by, you know, the backlash against Season of the Witch, which was the last one that he had produced. So there was a lot of frustration attached to his role in the franchise. And so he basically priced himself out of the director's fee. Basically, he said, yes, I'll do it if you pay me X amount of millions of dollars. And they were like, well, that's half the budget. We can't really do that. So she had to find an alternative. I believe the director on this film wound up being Steve Miner. Am I correct about that? I believe I'm correct about that. I'll look it up, and if I'm incorrect, then mea culpa. But so she found a director in Steve Miner, and they put this piece together. I like so many of the personal touches. I like that she's working again with her real life mother, Janet Leigh, the original Scream Queen from Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. I like that there's some fun to it. I really, really like that the final showdown, when it gets to between Laurie and Michael Myers again, that final showdown takes its time. It's about 20 to 25 minutes long, that final sort of showdown between the two of them. Lots of suspense, lots of upper hand, lower hand. And so there's just a lot of things about this film that really appeal to me for what I love about slashers and what I love about the Halloween franchise in general. So yeah, I'm very, very fond of this picture.
So you are correct in thinking that Steve Miner is the gentleman that directed this film, because he did indeed.
Nice.
But my thoughts are a little bit different than yours. Like, there's a lot of similarities, a little bit of differences. I loved how – I think one thing that I really enjoy, and I've voiced this outside of our show, but I think one of my favorite writers in comics right now is Tom King. And the reason that I love Tom King so much is because if you read Batman, if you read Mr. Miracle, he has been taking these, you know, bigger than life characters, and he's been really grounding them down and telling relatable character stories. And I feel like that's one thing that this film does extremely well, is that it takes the Laurie Strode character and says, okay, I've experienced this tragic event, and how do you cope with that? And so there's that we're getting both of them. So for H2O, there's one of two ways they could have gone. She learns self-defense and she becomes this like gun-toting awesome girl, which is what we're getting with the new one.
Right.
Or I can find something that's going to fill this void and function with this addiction or this, you know, just shut down. And that's really what she does, is for the first two acts of the film, she is essentially this functioning alcoholic. And I liked that it was so set in realism, that is what someone that went through that is, that's what they're going to do. And we'll talk a little bit more about this a little bit later on. But for me, like, the final act, once Michael builds himself, because I feel like they do establish a very surreal tone throughout the course of the first two acts. all that goes out the window the last act. Like, she's she's like now this like alert, you know what, I'm gonna take charge of this situation and I'm gonna kill myself. And she just kind of like spirals out of control, and then you kind of have these like, it's just like mega kill after mega kill. And I don't know, like, it, that's just where I thought, like, tonally, like, it just, it felt like it was one way, and then these characters just kind of shift it to this other way. I did enjoy, though, I will say that, like, it is a rewarding sense watching that last act, because, you know, you have been waiting since 1978 to kind of correctly stand up, to have these two face, you know, a more mature Laurie Strode, a more seasoned Michael Myers. It's an epic, beautiful thing that you get to see and experience. And but I don't know, like, to me, like, as a film, and it's kind of like when I'm looking at like the tonal consistencies, it just kind of goes out the window. That and there's also times where I feel like they acknowledge 4, 5, and 6, and then there's times where they act like it never happened. So it's did you kind of get that?
Yeah, no, I do understand, because it feels like they don't quite know how to integrate the greater mythology, because 4, 5, and 6 exist in the real world, but it's like, how much do you lean in on it, because she wasn't around for all of that, and you kind of imagine that she should have been in some capacity. And so, yeah, I do agree. It feels like the filmmakers wanted to give lip service to the previous chronology without actually having to progress that plot line, anything, especially like with the Curse of Thorn and all of the stuff that they had built up with the previous installments. It feels like they didn't quite know how to integrate that into this story, because this story was, again, so rooted back in the character of Laurie Strode. And I don't even disagree with you with the shift in tone. I think it didn't bother me clearly as much. But I do see what you're saying in terms of that last third feels of a different piece than the first two thirds.
Yeah. And so, like, I don't know, like, I think even because obviously Laurie Strode wasn't really around, like, obviously she had faked her death, but she had this daughter in Jamie Lloyd. Mm-hmm. And Jamie Lloyd is such a big part of this mythology too.
Yeah.
I understand what this new one is trying to go with, but they never, at least I don't know enough about H2O to say, okay, maybe they retconned it and they're like, okay, this is now what's canon. Halloween 1, 2, and H2O, and we're just going to kind of ignore these. They're there to exist on a different playing field, but I don't know. Like, it seems like they just kind of didn't really know where to take it. And like, even if, you know, Josh Hartnett would have kind of said something along the lines of maybe like, well, I had a sister, like, why does the Josh Hartnett character get to stay with mom when Jamie Lloyd
was just left out?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's a little sloppy. Halloween is one of my favorite slasher franchises, but I cannot give them any leg to stand on in terms of their proper continuity between installments. It's almost like each and everything is just kind of, now we're doing this now. Now we're going to go over to here. Well, and even as is evidenced by the new installment we have, which is, as we understand it, completely ignoring literally everything, and they're going all the way back to the original, even ignoring the original Halloween 2, which established Laurie as the sister to Michael Myers. So Halloween has butchered themselves on being able to follow a concrete timeline from one installment into the next, right down to I'm sure you mentioned this, or maybe you did, on the when in Halloween 2, you know, Dr. Loomis just blows up and yet is back with like some little burn scars on his face for 4, 5, and 6. It's really crazy how loosey-goosey Halloween has been with its continuity. So yeah, I mean, it is hard to wrap your brain around it, because there's no logic to it.
Right, and I didn't even mention this when we did our coverage of The Curse of Michael Myers on the PS Midnight Cast, but there, like, by the end, when you finally see Loomis for the first time in that film, there's no scar. Like, yeah, I actually had to pause it and rewind it, and I was like, what happened to his face? Like, how come it's not there anymore?
He's got Wolverine healing properties. It just progressively gets better. Oh, that's crazy. Oh, that's nuts. Yeah, I do as much as I enjoy, I think the big part of my enjoyment is just rooted in the character of Michael Myers, which, as we mentioned earlier, even Resurrection can't save, you know, his presence there doesn't save it. But yeah, there's nothing unlike like the Friday the 13th or the Nightmare on Elm Street or particularly the Saw franchises. There's more continuity from piece to piece to piece. They build onto what they had done previously, but Halloween seems to really have not grasped that almost at all. They really didn't know quite what to do with that after so much time.
Yeah, I was watching H2O this morning before I sat down and kind of like think about, you know, writing the reviews and constructing my thoughts for this episode. And I wrote on Facebook, I was like, people always complain about the continuity in the X-Men franchise, but no one is talking about the Halloween franchise.
So true. It's so true. X-Men ain't got nothing on Halloween.
No.
that is core. Absolutely.
I mean, at least X-Men retconned it with Days of Future Past.
That's true. They tried to find some way to merge all of the timelines together. But, oh my gosh, yeah, it's pretty rough.
But H2O actually also gave us the debut performance from Josh Hartnett. And
yes.
I kind of want to spend a couple minutes talking about this because Josh Hartnett, to me, I feel like was kind of like the one that stole the show. Like, I understand like this was like a big moment for the franchise. You're getting Laurie Strode back, Jamie Lee Curtis is back, and my goodness, she's dynamite in this film. But just Josh Hartnett and every interaction that he has, both with his mom and Laurie Strode, who is Carrie Tate, alter ego for this, I really enjoyed the performance that he gave and just the scenes that he had, particularly with kind of like not just – there's one scene in particular where he leaves campus to go down and – go down and get a gift for his girlfriend for their weekend together, and he gets caught, and there's like that scene, there's that moment between him and Laurie Strode, like it's so believable that they are mother and son, and I really liked his interaction. And then there's also that one scene between him and Michelle Williams, who plays his girlfriend in this, where I'm trying to think where he brings her back down to like this like boiler room of sorts to kind of like give this like candlelit dinner, and just like their performance together, like they had such good chemistry, and I think it's rare to see that kind of thing in this genre, to where you have a leading man and a leading woman that just have this like genuine happiness about them, but also that the chemistry feels genuine. I feel like it's kind of a lost art in the genre of horror.
I agree. And you used the word believable, I think a couple of times, and I couldn't agree more. That is the word that I would pin on Hartnett's performance. There's a verisimilitude to his entire performance, both the relationship he has, as you mentioned, with Laurie Strode as his mother, and the relationship with Michelle Williams as his girlfriend, that I do believe virtually every action and impulse that he puts forth on the screen, which is difficult to do in horror because a lot of horror props its people up merely as pawns to the greater game. And I feel like whether it was the attention to detail of the filmmakers or whether it was Hartnett's charisma and performance himself, whatever collaboration produced that performance from him in this film, we do get a very believable, very consistent feeling of not only his relationships, but also of him just being sort of an angsty later teen, you know, where he's like, hey, I'm trying to establish my own identity. I'm trying to establish my own sense of self, my own choices. But I have clearly lived for many, many years under the cloud of this thing that supposedly happened to my mother. And how do we cope with all of this? And I don't even know if I believe that story anymore. And even if I do, then what are we supposed to do about it? It's time to get over it. And so there's a lot that he brings to the table. And if memory serves me correctly from some of the behind the scenes information I've seen, that was a large part behind his getting the role, was the ability. Oh, the lights just went out. Oh, I got it back. That was a large part of him being able to acquire that role, is the ability of him to emote believably, to establish without working too hard, without people being able to kind of see the strings, he was able to just sort of be a presence on set and on screen in such a way that would draw the viewers in and would draw the rest of the actors in. So evidently he blew them away in auditions. And I'm continually surprised to find out that this is his first film, because I feel like he is such a part of all of these like early 2000s teen slasher thing, like The Faculty, and I'm remiss to find anything else at present, but I just feel like he was such a huge part of that era that I'm always surprised he got his start in H2O.
Yeah, and you know, we didn't even really talk about the fact of where this film even opens up, because one of the things that I've seen this movie dozens of times, but it took me till just doing these series of episodes and this like block of content that they actually bring back Nancy Stevens, who's the nurse in the first film and in the second film, and she comes back to kind of have this opening.
Mm-hmm.
And like that is one of the strongest opening cinematic openings that I can think of, because it takes, we talked about how messy this mythology handles itself, but you look at that and look at, you know, who's the person that would have this information, it would be her.
And yeah,
such a great nod to the original performances, but at the same time, like, it's also a brilliant move when it comes to storytelling as well.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that I do love that about this film, because she had been gone for so long in the other installments. So then to come back, I mean, essentially, spoiler alert, of course, come back to basically be dealt with. But that's one thing that I think that the Halloween movies are good at is their openings. They're really the Halloween movies have some really strong sort of preambles, as it were, and the opening 15 minutes in H2O is quite strong, featuring a very young Joseph Gordon-Levitt as well, and Nancy Stevens, the character of Nancy Stevens, it's great to see her sort of unpack all of this, introduce us all to where we are in the mythology, and then that whole sequence where she's kind of ducking and dodging what's happening in her house is fantastic. It's great suspense.
And then, like, the credits kind of rolling over this room as the cops are investigating.
Yeah.
Like, just kind of seeing, like, all the information about Lori and, like, Michael and, like, where she's kind of ended up. Like, it's a brilliant way to open this film. And I agree that, like, kind of going through all of these films, Halloween has always had really strong entrances that, whether you're talking about the first film and its iconic, you know, reveal of him killing the sister, or the continuation in the second film to make it feel like that sequel, or even this one, to me, I feel like they've mastered the art of the opening. Now they just need to kind of master the art of the full film.
The continuation. Yes.
I love the Halloween films. It's the entire franchise. It's a beautiful franchise. It's just they don't always have the strongest contenders or moves in this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it's this weird sort of, not a love-hate, but a love... Oh! I don't even know how you spell that, but it's like... Yeah, it's kind of like... Oh man, I love this so much. And then you see them fumble these balls. That's kind of like, oh, that's not that great. Now, this is a different film, but like, have you seen the producer's cut of Curse of Michael Myers?
I haven't. And we just covered it for our spinoff show, PS Midnight Cast. And
okay.
Like, I was reading like all the different alternate. I was like, this sounds like the Blade Runner of horror films.
Right? It's funny. Well, so you can pick the Blu-ray up for like $8 or whatever. So I'm not about to go too deep into it, because as of yet, I have not seen it. My birthday is on the horizon, and I am saving up like very special to be like, okay, I'm very familiar with Curse of Michael Myers. I've never seen the producer's cut. But when my birthday comes, that's going to be like my pop the popcorn, get the drinks ready, and that's going to be like my movie night, is to finally see, okay, show me what you got, producer's cut. But I'm fully expecting, from what the rumors and echoes are of Vandom, for it to be like what we're talking about with Halloween and just be a completely different thing on it in and of itself. They talk about something like 70 minutes of either different or new footage. And I'm like, the film's only 90 minutes long. How can you have 70 minutes of different or new footage? I don't even know how that math works out, but supposedly that's what it is. I'm curious and excited to see it.
I might be joining you on that crusade, because like, it's funny, like doing research, and you guys can, we'll have a link below to check out our episode coverage of it. But one of the things that I had done come across is when you're watching the theatrical trailer, there is actually a scene from the producer's cut in there
with the
Tommy character, and it's completely scrapped in the final film. I was like, what the heck?
Wow. Yeah, I'm so curious to see what it's going to be like. I did recently refresh with Curse of Michael Myers so that when I went into the producer's cut, I could know, like, okay, what have they done differently? Where have they retooled everything? And I would love to see, so, you know, getting back to H2O, there's so many of these installments that supposedly went through nightmares of editing and studio handling and trying to get it right, trying to thread the needle and really struggling to do so. I would imagine there's probably multiple cuts that could be called together of unused footage for basically every installment, except for perhaps the first one, since that was such a singular vision of Carpenter's. I would love to see alternate takes on all of these. There's some pretty extensive Blu-ray editions out there, but none that give us more than that for anything other than The Curse of Michael Myers.
Correction. There is apparently an extended cut of the original version.
Oh, is there now? Oh, see, now that I've got to seek out. Wow. Okay.
I just learned about it thanks to our friend Sasha, the Princess of Darkness. Apparently, yeah, they're in like the 70s and 80s. There was like this period where if you wanted to sell your rights to a film for television, you had to meet like a certain expectation. So that's why when you hear about the first Superman Christopher Reeves film, there's two different versions that exist. You have a film that we got theatrically, but then you also have the 3-hour that's also cut. And so what she was telling me today was that essentially Carpenter, they brought back all of they didn't scrap anything. Like the vision that you cast for the original theatrical 1978 version, that is the vision that he had. They brought everyone back together while they were filming Halloween 2 and shot brand new footage and then spliced it all in. Apparently it gives backstory, more depth to Dr. Loomis, more backstory to
My gosh. Well, now I gotta seek that cut out too. Now I've got homework.
It's apparently it's pretty expensive. We looked online.
Oh, really?
Today. It's been produced by Anchor Bay, is the only publisher that does it. They produce them on DVD, and it's like $30 to $35 a copy.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. Well, for the diehard, I get it. But man, I would be fascinated to see what extended scenes they had in that. Because Halloween is just. Yeah, I don't know quite. I can't quite put my finger on what resonates so much with me about this particular slasher franchise versus a few others. But there's something about. I think there is a, you know, some of your core slashers have distinct motivations, and there's something about the character of Michael Myers that, at least in the early inception, he is just this shape. He's just this force. This inexplicable. Constant predatory force after you. And there's something very compelling to me about that kind of idea, the roots of Michael Myers as a character, which again, we do see it return to that in H2O. He's after her specifically and after anybody tangential to her, but the motivations are really not clear. She didn't wrong him in any way. There's no specific sort of, bad blood like the Jason Voorhees that he's trying to sort of avenge. It's just he just is this predatory force. And that strikes a note of so much like the chaotic element of our fears. We worry and wonder about like, oh, this is going to be this is just going to come to me senselessly. And I think Michael Myers taps into a bit of that. And I think that's part of why I find him so compelling.
Well, I think too, I'm glad that you kind of went with the brother sister aspect, because that was kind of one of the, you know, kind of winding down just really quick. There's a scene in the end right before she cuts off his head, and here he's just kind of like reaching out, like it's like the whole like idea of Michael Myers like being scary was that you couldn't see his eyes, because you know there's just something about eyes that if you can see them, it's not as terrifying, but you can clearly see his eyes. And him and Jamie Lee like Curtis's Laurie Strode, they have this moment. Mm-hmm. Like, what did you think about that?
See, here's what's funny. I know too much about that, because when I saw the film originally, I found that to be really compelling, of this idea of like, okay, you are dangerous, but I love you. There's something, you know, familial relationships can be complicated. It's like so many people who deal with siblings or with parents, that you're like, man, this was a really, in many ways, toxic relationship. Some people have that dynamic, but there's still, it's like, I'm still tied to it. I'm still bound by this bond that can't quite be articulated. And the first time I saw H2O, that's what I interpreted it as. And I think people who watch H2O in a bubble, that could be what you walk away from with that. It's like, well, there's this draw to him. Do I really understand? Is there a possibility he could be redeemed? Is there something there that I'm missing? But something you may or may not know is that when they were filming that moment, Jamie Lee Curtis made it very, very clear that she wanted Michael Myers dead. She wanted this to be like the end of it. And the producers knew, like, the only way the studio greenlit this is if we left it open for a sequel. So you chop off his, like, there's no way for a sequel. There's no way we can get this, you know, this done. So I don't know if you know that they conceived the reveal of Resurrection while they were filming H2O. That was not a later retcon. Like, that was something they knew going into it. So the actor in the Michael Myers mask at that point knows that he is not really Michael Myers. In fact, they filmed the reveal of Michael Myers in the you know, the paramedics outfit that he supposedly changed into for Resurrection. They filmed that during H2O with the full intent of, we will use this later in a sequel, which I did not learn until recently, but I was like, holy cow. So apparently they knew going into that they were setting this whole moment up, which I don't know, that makes me feel a little weird about it, because it kind of undermines the interpretation that I get about that bond I was speaking of.
Yeah, I didn't know that, so like now I feel like my entire rebuttal is moot, because I'm just like, well, they planned it that way, then that's smart. I'll give them that, because the first,
it was clever,
15 minutes of Resurrection, like that's the only, that's like the best part, and like it's not even
I get it.
We're moving on to Roads to Hope. This is the point in our show where we engage with our guests of the week, and we talk about a theme of either mental health or hope that we're pulling from the episode's source material. And for this one, I said a little bit earlier that we would come back to Laurie's drinking problem, and here we are. So Laurie experiences in the original 1978 film, she experiences this devastating just exhaustion of loss and fear, and it's a life-changing event. And death, especially when you see it firsthand, it is a life-changing event. And you can either speak about it or you can suffer. And we're a show that we believe that you are worth every breath that you take. Mm-hmm. That's why we want to encourage you guys that, look, addiction's never the answer. We went through all last year. We celebrated the life of Chris Farley in effort to raise awareness of addiction and help and prevention, and just knowing that there is a better way, and conversation is one of the hardest ways, don't get me wrong, but it's one of the healthiest ways to cope and to offset the trauma and the devastation that you experience. And experiencing something like watching your friends murdered right in front of you, it's something that's going to change you, and it's something that's going to, you're going through. And I'm not saying that, hey, maybe you've seen that, maybe you need to talk about it, we're here for you. Maybe you just had a bad day and you need someone to vent to. We have resources in the descriptions below for that, or you guys can even go to victimsandvillains.net. But conversations should be the driving force of healing, because the first step to healing and the first step towards overcoming something is admitting that, hey, this is a thing in my life. This is a thing that I need attention for. And that was just kind of one thing that I really walked away with the Laurie Strode character. And even as much as I hate the transition between the second and third act in this film, there is a beautiful thing of realism of truth of, you know, what it means to face your fears head on. And that's something that we encourage you guys to do as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I feel so strongly about when the conversation of addiction comes up in hopelessness is I feel like so many things start as an outlet of what I guess I would call a numbing agent. I'm not the only one to call it that, but you begin to get involved with something that just shuts it out. It just tunes it out for a little while, so you can feel like you can get some momentary relief, but then you begin to deal with diminishing returns on that numbing agent. When for many people that can become a kind of a denial, and they can retreat to that rather than actively facing what it is that drove them to that. And I think conversation is so important. I think understanding that there really is no shame in having experienced something traumatic and in wrestling with something traumatic, and that there, one of the most detrimental things to us would be to simply, because our bodies cry out to us in pain to let us know something is wrong. And I feel like emotionally and mentally, the same thing happens. Sometimes ourselves cry out to us in pain that something is wrong. And what we have a tendency to want to do with emotional or mental pain is we will have a tendency to want to numb it rather than to want to be open about it, because there is a large degree of perhaps embarrassment is the right word, or a stigma, or a shame attached to it. And for myself, that hurts my heart, because there should be no reason that anybody should feel shame for any pain they are experiencing, for anything that they are going through that is hurting them. I want each and every person, that's why I'm so pleased and privileged to be on your show and so happy that your show exists, because every avenue that provides somebody the opportunity to go and be, you know, get some help and say, speak their heart, speak their mind, and be able to open up about the pain that they're experiencing without retreating into something that is merely going to numb them and cripple them and cause them to be dependent upon something else. Those outlets for conversation and those outlets for hope are so vital and are so important.
Yeah. So if you guys need someone to talk to and you want to start conversations, please feel free to reach out to us on any of our social media. We have links in the descriptions. If you guys go to victimsandvillains.net/hope, you guys can see things tailored to specific people groups like LGBT, veterans. You guys can find counselors and more. But with that, where can people find more information on Fear of God?
Certainly. You can reach out to us. The easiest and best way is probably through Twitter, @TheFearOfGod. We do have both a Facebook page and a Facebook group. You can like the page to follow it. You can request to join the group, and we will gladly accept you. We'll gladly welcome you to the community. We are also, you can email us, fearofgodpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word, fearofgodpodcast@gmail.com. I am on Twitter, @ReedLackey. My co-host Nathan Rouse is on Twitter, @TheNathanRouse. So there's a number of avenues. And as we say, you know, we're talking about conversation. We treat every inquiry that comes in as an avenue for conversation. And so we love hearing from listeners. We love engaging with listeners. Things you love about the horror genre, things you're inquiring about from a faith perspective, things you're inquiring about from the horror genre. We just love any and all shapes and sizes. So we welcome you.
That's beautiful. Please go check out their show. It is a pleasure in your ears. That sounded super awkward. And you guys can find us everywhere: Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and iTunes. Make sure that you guys like, follow, and subscribe to us. And if you guys like what we stand for, make sure that you guys support us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains. Consider being a part of our Facebook group, Hope Culture, and sign up for our monthly newsletter. Not to mention, again, you guys can go to victimsandvillains.net/hope for resources if you guys are struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression. And until next time, remember to keep talking nerd, talking hope, and speaking nothing else. And until next time, if it moves, it might not be dead.
Culture, artist owned, fan supported.